From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Strip away all the mumbo-jumbo, and it comes to this, says Ken Pollack. The world economy is utterly dependent on the unimpeded flow of Persian Gulf oil. The United States cannot permit that flow to be threatened, not by Saddam, not by nukes in Iran, not by civil unrest in the Gulf. So Saddam's out. What's next? Tonight on Point, high stakes, high strategy, and America's high-risk future in the Persian Gulf. But first, we begin with first-hand descriptions of conditions for prisoners held by the American military at Guantanamo, Cuba. 41 of the 658 prisoners detained on suspicion of terrorism over the past 18 months have recently been released without charges. New York Times correspondents Neil Lewis and Carlotta Gall have gathered the stories of Guantanamo prisoners now returned to Afghanistan and Pakistan. Stories of isolation, confinement, depression, and attempted suicides among detainees. Earlier today, I spoke with Neil Lewis and asked him how the detainees described conditions at Guantanamo.
Well, the prisoners who were released, most of them were let go in Kabul, Afghanistan. And an article in today's New York Times written with my colleague Carlotta Gall, who's there, she interviewed two of them at least and talked to some others. But the two of them paint a picture of some despair on the part of many of the detainees, not because of any physical mistreatment or abuse, but for two basic reasons. The conditions, they're kept in cells most of the time except for 2 15-minute periods a week when they get some limited exercise and have showers. But most of all, the depression, which has led to 28 suicide attempts among 18 of them, comes from the uncertainty about their future. These are people taken from one part of the world and brought to Cuba, the base at Guantanamo Bay, and they do not know if they're there forever, if they'll ever be tried, ever be sent home. So it's that uncertainty which is the greatest factor weighing on them and has contributed to this depression.
Neil, we'll talk about that, but first, the physical setting there. What did these prisoners face when they first arrived at Guantanamo, and what are the conditions like now?
When they first arrived, they were put into a facility that was known as Camp X-Ray, probably because it was sort of very exposed to the elements. It was open on the sides with wooden roofs, and that existed for a few months. They were very small cells, approximately 8 feet by 8 feet, and pretty much exposed to the elements on the sides. Since then, they moved into what is now called Camp Delta on the southeastern tip of the base at Cuba, and it's a more modern facility, prefabricated cells. There are buildings with about 20 cells to each building, and the sides of these cells are chain-link sort of perforated fences so the inmates can talk to people on either side and see them. The people who keep them have also become much more sensitive to the inmates' Islamic faith. In the beginning, there were several misunderstandings. For example, some of the inmates wrapped towels over their heads, and the guards made them take them off, thinking it was a security problem. But now they have a fairly good regimen for the religion. An Islamic chaplain, the Muslim call to prayer, rings out 5 times a day. Each inmate has a Quran and a little item to help keep it off the floor and is given prayer oils and beads. Mm. So the physical conditions are not atrocious, but the psychological conditions, psychiatrists and outside human rights groups say, are quite debilitating. The military somewhat disagrees with that assessment.
Of the 650-plus detainees, there are, 50-some Pakistanis, 150 Saudis, and then many other nationalities represented, a sprinkling of, Yemenis, 83, Canadians, Britons, Algerians, Australians, even
right.
One Swede.
Right. And a handful, more than a dozen people from Kuwait.
From Kuwait, of course. Who has been released from that larger number and why?
Mostly Afghans and Pakistanis and 5 Saudis. The reason is they have, after being there for more than 18 months, the military has just started to sort out the people there and determine that some handful of them present no threat and offer no resource for intelligence. They've all been interrogated many times, and so in addition to releasing some of them, the authorities have moved a few dozen into a new medium security facility alongside. And in this facility called Camp 4, they can congregate among themselves. And it's pretty much like a halfway house before they get released. Mm. At the same time that they're beginning this process of releasing, we're also anticipating very soon this summer some military tribunals for a handful of the inmates who will be charged with crimes.
There's talk then of a permanent prison facility at Guantanamo Bay and even potentially an execution chamber there. But you and Carlotta Gall, or Carlotta Gall, spoke with prisoners who have been released. Neil, can you take us into some of the detail of how they described the psychological challenge, their individual psychological challenges of holding up at Camp X-Ray and after?
Well, a common theme in the two main interviews was this sense of isolation and desperation over this uncertain future and anger at the guards, really a sense of, you know, what psychiatrists would call anomie, not knowing what the future is. Of the 28 suicide attempts, they were all foiled. There's no successful suicide. However, one Saudi teacher, they're almost all suffocation or attempted hangings. One Saudi teacher suffered such severe brain damage that he will not recover, although he is alive.
And one of the men Carlotta Gall spoke with, Shah Muhammad, a Pakistani 20 years old, claims that he tried four times to end his life.
That's right. And the military has not contradicted that, as far as I know yet, although we have talked to them about it. As I say, there were 28 suicide attempts with 18 people, so there were repeat attempters. The military asserts that it has gotten better at monitoring inmates prone to suicide, that it has trained the guards better, that when they see a suicide attempt underway, they go in and prepare and immediately try to stabilize the person. And they have a fairly modern medical facility. There is dispute among the outside groups in the military as to the treatment for these people. About 1 in 20 of the inmates are being treated with antidepressants, and the suicide rate is considered fairly high. Military authorities have suggested that most of the mental problems were brought to Guantanamo by the inmates, that these were sociopathic or mentally ill persons, whereas some of the outside human rights groups assert that the conditions are the very kind of thing that exacerbates these problems.
And what did the men tell you and Carlotta Gall that they were told at Guantanamo about the conditions, the duration of their likely stay? Were they told anything?
They were not told anything definitive because they could not be. In an earlier part of the camp, a commandant who has since gone did make announcements over the public address system saying, "I'm sorry, essentially, I'm sorry, I can't tell you how long you'll be here, that's out of my hands, but we'll try to have humane conditions," and so on and so forth. But he acknowledged forthrightly something that, again, was the foundation of what these released inmates say was the source of the great dismay and depression, that the keepers actually in Guantanamo in the military do not control the final resolution of this. That's really up to the White House and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, who have to decide, you know, when to start sorting these people out more quickly. So now the International Committee of the Red Cross has recently made a plea for the administration to get on with it more swiftly.
So now several dozen have been released. Are they all set free? Are some going to prison? And what did, of those that you spoke with, what does their attitude toward their imprisonment in the United States appear to be at this point?
Well, the ones we spoke to recently were resentful. Some were kind of, in an earlier release, were kind of pleased at the treatment they got there. There have been no credible reports of physical abuse at Guantanamo. There have been more
that is of beatings, let's
beatings,
say.
That's right. There have been credible reports of them having been abused in Afghanistan before they went to Guantanamo. So the first batch they released a few months ago went back on average 13 pounds heavier with new blue jeans and new Korans. Some of them seemed more cheerful to reporters, at least when they were dispersed immediately in that setting. Others, now that my colleague Carlotta Gall has talked to them, are quite critical of being held all this time, no charges, no evidence against them, and no apology, and no money in their pocket. To your earlier question, of the 41 or so that have been released, I believe five are Saudis, one went on to freedom, and four others remain in Saudi government custody.
And of the balance, imprisoned or free?
Free.
One wonders if these will be lifelong enemies of the United States or if they'll somehow get over it.
Well, that's an interesting question because, for example, I had interviewed not the inmates but some of their families because they are allowed to write to their families through the Red Cross. Mm-hmm. And I had discovered that some of them had gone to Guantanamo, pretty non-religious folks, But in the early months, they had little to do but spend time reading the Quran, and have since become kind of devout and perhaps militant Islamic believers.
Neil Lewis, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Neil Lewis is Washington correspondent for the New York Times. He spoke with us from New York. Our guest tonight, longtime CIA analyst and Persian Gulf expert with the National Security Council, Kenneth Pollack, made an urgent case for war in the months leading up to the invasion of Iraq. Now, Saddam is out, but the Persian Gulf security challenge roars on. It is a project of years, probably decades. And Ken Pollack is taking the long, strategic view of what he sees as American imperatives and options in the region. The stakes are as big as they come. The challenges and consequences of success and failure, vast. Tonight on Point, big picture U.S. strategy in the Persian Gulf post-Saddam. Are you ready for a fresh American commitment to a dominating role in the Persian Gulf? Do you see strategic U.S. control of the region as an imperative or a choice? Does America have the strength, the skill, the subtlety to manage the cauldron of the Persian Gulf? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Kenneth Pollack, Director of Research at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy. He was Director for Persian Gulf Affairs at the National Security Council from 1999 to 2001 and was a longtime Iran-Iraq military analyst with the CIA. He is author of the book, The Threatening Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq, published last fall, and a new article in the July-August issue of Foreign Affairs, Securing the Gulf. Good evening and welcome, Ken Pollack.
Thanks very much, Tom. Thanks for having me here.
Thanks for joining us. Ken Pollack, you write that as tricky as it's been to deal with the Iranian Navy some years ago in the Persian Gulf and most recently with Saddam Hussein, these challenges pale in comparison to what the United States is going to be up against in the years ahead. What do you mean by that?
Well, in some ways, the threats posed by Iran and Iraq were rather straightforward. There was an Iranian naval threat in the Persian Gulf that lent itself to dealing with being dealt with by our naval and air forces.
This is back when they had the sort of pinprick attacks on tankers.
Correct, right, when they were trying to shut down the tanker trade to the, through the Persian Gulf during the Iran-Iraq War. Same thing with Iraq. Fairly straightforward threat, a big Iraqi army capable of invading Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. The threats that could destabilize the Persian Gulf, impair the security of the region, threaten the oil flows of the region, are going to be much more subtle, much more sophisticated, and unfortunately reinforcing in some pretty nasty ways. Iran is determined to acquire a nuclear weapon. In fact, all the evidence indicates that the invasion of Iraq has simply spurred them to greater efforts because they seem to have concluded that the only way that you can ever really be sure that you can stop the United States from intervening in your politics is if you have nuclear weapons, basically the Korean scenario as opposed to what the Iraqis went through.
And the Gulf states?
Well, the Gulf states are obviously our allies, and they would like to stay that way, but they've got some real internal problems, and all of them are starting to try to come to grips with those different problems, but they've been doing it in kind of a herky-jerky fashion. There's no certainty that they are going to be able to deal with those problems, and in particular, we need to be able to try to give them the space to deal with those problems, to reform their own internal structures before real problems start occurring in those countries.
But it's hard to give them space when, as you would have it, the United States has an imperative to make sure this oil keeps flowing freely and a need, perhaps, to keep troops nearby.
Well, I wouldn't quite put it that way, Tom, because in point of fact, what I go into in the argument is that, or into the in the article, is that while I do believe that the stability of the Persian Gulf and the flow of Gulf oil is critical to the United States, and the United States is going to have some role in the security of the Persian Gulf, it's just inevitable. In point of fact, what I'd like to see the United States do is explore more creative approaches so that we don't have such a domineering approach in the Persian Gulf. One of my fears is that if we have a massive troop presence in the Gulf, exactly the kind of thing that you'd probably want if what you were trying to do is deter Iran once Iran has nuclear weapons.
You may make enemies with that. Ken Pollack, stand by. We've got to take a short break. You're saying not a domineering presence, but it sure sounds to me like a dominating one. We're looking tonight at the big picture future of the Persian Gulf, high stakes, high strategy. Are you ready to see the United States openly commit long-term to a controlling role one way or another in the Persian Gulf? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the big picture future of the Persian Gulf. High stakes, high strategy, and America right in the thick of it. My guest tonight is Ken Pollack, director of the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He was director of Persian Gulf Affairs at the National Security Council from 1999 to 2001. He spent years as the top Iran-Iraq military analyst at the CIA. He's author of last fall of The Threatening Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq. Now he says the U.S. has a big, multi-decade probably, challenge in the Persian Gulf, and it goes well beyond Iraq. You can join the conversation tonight. Are Americans honest with themselves about the strategic imperative to defend, to control Persian Gulf oil? Do you accept that control as an imperative? And how can America determine the fate of Mideast oil without the Mideast blowing up? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ken Pollack, I'd be interested to hear you on this. You write in a very unvarnished way, a way that we didn't exactly hear front and center in the run-up to war with Iraq, about U.S. interest in this region, about the world's dependence on Persian Gulf oil. We heard all about weapons of mass destruction. You wrote about them yourself. But you put it in much starker terms, that the United States simply cannot permit a real threat to the free flow of this oil. A, make that case, and B, why don't we hear that put more forthrightly? Is there something? Is the White House ashamed to say it straight out?
Yeah. First, a key point, Tom. I want to disagree with you on one thing, which is I do not believe the United States should be controlling the Persian Gulf's oil. I actually think that trying to do that is a recipe for disaster. What I do believe is that the United States has a critical interest, and it's not just the interest of the United States, in fact, it's the interest of the entire world, in making sure that Persian Gulf oil continues to flow freely.
So now, it's kind of a semantic issue, Ken Pollack. I mean, you're saying there is an imperative. The oil must flow freely, and as I read you, it must flow within a price range that the world economy can handle, and the United States must insist upon and ensure that. You might or might not call that control, but that is a very hands-on interest that you don't want Washington
right.
to take its eye off.
No, that I would absolutely agree with. I mean, I think there is a big difference between saying control and saying exactly what you describe, but nevertheless, you're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. This is critical to the United States, and let me answer your question, which I think is a very important one. You know, it is kind of a dirty little secret. Nobody in Washington likes to say it, because if you say, look, the oil is important, people immediately assume that you mean that whether the oil is a dollar at the gas pump or $2 at the gas pump or $4, that's what you're talking about. That's not it at all. The problem is this. We have built an economy, the entire world has built an economy over the last 40 or 50 years that is built on a foundation of cheap oil. If that foundation is removed, if oil prices jump by a significant margin, $100 a barrel, whatever the number is, if there's a major jump, it will cause the global economy to collapse. Now, of course, in my mind, this also raises some very important questions about our energy policy. Mm-hmm. And I think, hopefully some of your listeners are also asking, is this the kind of economy that we ought to be having 40, 50 years into the future, especially given how dependent the world is on Persian Gulf oil and how unstable the Persian Gulf is?
But it's the economy we have, and we're going to have it for a while, decades at least.
Right. Unfortunately, we're not going to change it in the next 10, 20, 30 years.
So I read you saying, all right, Persian Gulf, and states, nations that surround the Persian Gulf, be as free as you want unless you do anything that Washington perceives as a threat to the free flow of oil.
To a certain extent. I mean, in point of fact, Washington has allowed a whole bunch of real variations in price. There have been some real shocks to the system, the 1973 oil crisis, the 1979 oil crisis, which indicates that I think not just Washington, but the rest of the free world can actually allow for a fairly significant fluctuation in the price.
So there's a range of wobble here, but it's not unlimited. Ken Pollack,
correct.
Walk us through, just for context here, you describe a couple of large strategic structures that the U.S. has put down over this region since the British pulled back from east of Suez in the late 60s and said to Uncle Sam, it's all yours.
Right. And basically, we started out by saying, when the British pulled out from east of Suez in 1968, the U.S. was in the middle of the Vietnam War. And the last thing that we were looking to do was to take on another big problem, another big challenge like the Persian Gulf. So what we did was we set up a policy called Twin Pillars, where we were going to try to rely on the Saudis, and in particular the Shah of Iran, and use them as basically regional policemen to do our job for us. That collapsed with the Iranian Revolution. Now, shortly after that, we tried another approach, which was called the Tilt to Iraq, which was basically saying, all right, Iran is the big problem. Maybe we can work with this guy, Saddam Hussein. You know, he seems nasty and brutal, but at least he opposes the Iranians. Maybe we can use him to balance off the Iranians.
And for a while that worked until he became too bad and invaded Kuwait.
It only worked as long as he was fighting the Iranians, and then it was clearly shown to be a complete fiasco. In the 1990s, we tried a different approach we called dual containment. The problem with dual containment was that it required a very heavy U.S. presence in the region.
That is containing both Iraq and Iran.
Correct, exactly. And we did that by having bases in all of the Gulf states, by having a whole bunch of troops in these different countries.
And containing those two because each of them or both could be a threat to the major oil flow out of the Persian Gulf.
Exactly. And in so doing, because we had that troop presence there, it exacerbated the internal situation of all the other Gulf states, and you had increasing popular unrest in the Gulf states, including in particular Saudi Arabia, as a result of that. Now, those internal problems in the Gulf states, they've been mounting for a while, for two or three decades, but they've gotten a lot worse as a result of our presence there.
Now, on this side of Saddam, you describe what you call a triple threat. Could you lay out the three pieces?
Sure. It's tough to do so quickly, but I'll try to. There are three interlocking problems with the Persian Gulf. First, there's the problem of Iraqi security, which is that at some point in time, the Iraqis are going to rebuild their strength. When that happens, we've got a problem, because any Iraq that is strong enough to balance against Iran is also strong enough to invade Saudi Arabia and Kuwait.
Which you call the Iraqi paradox.
Correct. So, in other words, when we're thinking about a new security structure for the Gulf, we've got to deal with that problem. The second problem is the fact that in Iran, we've got a situation where we've got a regime that we don't much care for, in fact, that the Iranian people don't much care for. Now, it's clear that that regime is going to be gone at some point in time because it is simply demographically impossible for it to stay in power.
Because younger Iranians don't support the clerical powers at the top.
The young dominate Iran. There's 70% of the population under 30, and they can't stand this regime.
Right, so why not just wait?
Well, the problem there is the Iranians are trying very hard to get nuclear weapons.
Who's going to believe that after the Iraq example?
Well, the IAEA just issued a report yesterday indicating that they're very concerned about Iran. But I agree with you. I think we have to be careful about any estimates of Iranian nuclear progress. Nevertheless, it would be very problematic if the Iranian hardliners, those in power today, were to acquire nuclear weapons.
So what's the Iranian paradox, as you describe it, Kim?
The Iranian paradox is that those steps that we would want to take to deal with an Iran with nuclear weapons might actually put off Iranian regime change. Because the things that you want to do to deal with a nuclear Iran, a very aggressive posture, tight containment of Iran, troops around its borders, are going to look very threatening to the Iranian people.
So kind of pushing Iran around could make the young reformers and reformers throughout Iran angry at the United States and encourage solidarity.
Exactly. Right. And they will be more receptive to the hardline arguments that the United States is a threat to them and therefore they need to rally around the current government.
Okay. This is looking complicated so far. Iraq has to be strong enough to hold together but not so strong as to threaten the oil supplies in Kuwait or really Iran. Iran, you're saying we need to push it off its nuclear track but without souring Iranian reformists against the U.S., and then you turn to the Gulf states, Qatar, Bahrain, and including Saudi Arabia, and you say, here's a can of worms also.
Exactly, because here the problem is that what you would want to do in the abstract to defend against the threat from Iran and secondarily from Iraq, have lots of troops in the region, would be the worst possible thing for the Gulf states in terms of them reforming their own internal economic and political systems, which is probably the only way that we're going to help them stave off some kind of violent internal changes in the future.
You're saying big U.S. U.S. troop presences make these governments look like stooges of Washington?
That's certainly a big part of it. Part of it is just that they don't like the fact that their populations just don't like the fact that we have that there are infidel troops in the land of the two holy mosques.
So you're saying Washington may need troops there to keep Iran and Iraq in check, but troops in the region make the populations of Saudi Arabia and the smaller countries along the Gulf unhappy, maybe
exactly.
Lead to civil war or political turmoil?
Conceivably. And, you know, 10 years ago, I think everyone would have laughed at that idea. Right now, the Middle East experts, they're not laughing so hard. I don't think anybody expects it to happen tomorrow, but I think more and more people are looking at it as a real possibility out there in the future.
So we've got a major juggling act for Washington to keep this free flow of oil, the ultimate imperative, as you describe it, for the next decades, to keep all these things balanced off one against another.
Exactly.
You lay out several potential paths for dealing with that, Ken Pollack. Each, though, faces the paradoxes that you've laid out. The first you describe is get back over the horizon, get the troops essentially out of there.
Right. This basically says, look, the biggest problem that we have is the internal threat from the Gulf states themselves. Iran is mostly weak right now. It probably isn't going to have a nuclear weapon for a while. Iraq is obviously flat on its back. So let's just get the troops out of there. It's certainly what the Bush administration is already starting to do, pulling the troop presence out of Saudi Arabia, which they've already announced that they're going to do.
Now, when you say out, you don't mean completely out. You're thinking the Fifth Fleet would stay in Bahrain, that the big, huge new Air Force facility would stay in Qatar.
Exactly. I mean, I think there would still be some residual presence in the Gulf, but it would be greatly scaled back. We might even keep a pre-positioned set of army equipment in Kuwait if the Kuwaitis wanted it. But we would greatly reduce our presence in the region. There would be fewer U.S. military personnel in the region full-time.
And in Iraq?
Iraq, I think it would depend on what the Iraqi people want. At some point in time, the Iraqi people are going to have a new government. And at that point in time, I think we ought to leave it up to them to decide whether or not they want Americans there. If they do, that's great. If they don't, I think we ought to get out.
Are you serious about that, Ken Pollack? I mean, you were such a big proponent of getting in there. It was such a huge strategic piece. Now U.S. forces are there. We've heard the Pentagon talk about multiple bases there, essentially in perpetuity. You are insisting in this article that Iraq will never be allowed to have weapons of mass destruction again. That requires some kind of oversight, maybe armed oversight. Could the U.S., do you really see them as pulling out?
Again, for me, the critical issue with regard to Iraq is building a stable, pluralist Iraq over the future. If we can do that, that will be an enormous accomplishment. And the question of U.S. presence in Iraq has to be tied to that larger issue. If the Iraqis want us there, if the Iraqi people believe that it will be helpful to them, basically the way that the Germans and Japanese did after World War II, that's terrific. Under those circumstances, I think it would be great to have U.S. bases in Iraq.
But if U.S. forces are still in Bahrain and still in Qatar and still in Kuwait, what kind of pullback is that?
Well, in point of fact, from the 1990s, it would be a very significant one. We'd probably reduce our presence by as much as 80 to 90%. We could get down to about 10 to 20% of what we had there in the 1990s. There would be a residual force in Bahrain. There would be a residual force in Qatar. But it would be much smaller than what was there in the 1990s. There would be a residual force in Kuwait, but it would be much smaller. And you would probably eliminate the presence in Saudi Arabia. You might eliminate it from the UAE. Conceivably, you might eliminate it from Oman as well.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Matt's calling from Chelmsford, Massachusetts. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And I've got to say, this show is starting to take. I have no time anymore. I mean, it's. You do a great job. I just love it.
We're eating up your evening. Sorry, Matt.
Yeah, and you know, my kids are waiting in the backyard for me to join them in the basketball game.
Our apologies.
It's kind of tougher. It's happening every night now too. But you're doing a great job. Really enjoy. Just one question, and I'll listen off the air. But yeah. I mean, United States is at least perceived by a lot of, especially the Western world, especially Europe and Russia and stuff, is on a unilateral bent. I mean, we seem to be doing this all by ourselves. And, you know, I was listening to the BBC News earlier today. Mm-hmm. There's talks about the chaos and confusion that what's happening amongst the American occupation there. A lot
in Iraq now. Yeah.
In Iraq right now and stuff. And I'm wondering if we can do all this alone, or if we've made a major mistake and broken this, you know, alliance that we had with Western Europe, the expertise that France brings and stuff, and, you know, where we're going to be 2 or 3 years from now if we're, you know, if there's still this endless chaos, and I think it's very difficult for us to deal with.
Ken, it's a great question, Matt. Let me put it to Ken Pollack. Ken, your response.
Yeah, I mean, look, I agree with the sentiments. It's why before we went into war with Iraq, I actually had a whole bunch of different conditions that I wanted the U.S. To obtain before we went in. One of the big ones was building an international coalition for this, because I recognized that the reconstruction of Iraq was going to be a major task that would require resources beyond that even of the United States. And what's more, that you know, the Western alliance is something that has served us very well for 50 years, and it would be nice to keep it going even after Iraq. And therefore, when you went into Iraq, you wanted to do it with support and not antagonize the rest of the world.
But Ken, you know that large portions of Europe absolutely disagreed with the American position, and I would say by extension, somehow disagreed with your analysis.
I would absolutely disagree with that, Tom. To tell you the truth, I spoke to any number of Europeans, any number of journalists, and what I kept hearing from them overwhelmingly time and again was, boy, that's a very compelling case.
But we saw hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of Europeans in the street. They were not shouting about the case for invading Iraq.
Well, what I'd say to you is, they'd never heard my case. In fact, again, every European I spoke to kept saying, why don't you make your case? I had French and Italian publishers who wanted to reprint my book. I had journalists who were trying to excerpt the book in the papers, because what they kept saying to me was, you, Ken Pollack, have a somewhat different case from the administration that we actually find much more compelling than their case.
But the Europeans were saying, let's go for containment, not this military confrontation, certainly not military invasion.
Well, again, I would disagree with that. Some Europeans were saying that.
Well,
that
the heads of state.
That was the French position. The position of most Europeans was somewhat more subtle, and it was basically, we'd like to find other ways to deal with this problem. We don't believe, United States, that you've exhausted all of those other ways. And truth to tell, my argument for war was not an immediate one. I think that you could have set this war up for much further into the future, several years down the road, and allowed all of these other policies to go out, to test them, to demonstrate that they probably weren't going to work. And if they actually did work, listen, I would have been all for it. I just, given my experience with 12 years of Iraq policy, having tried so many other approaches, I didn't think they would.
And to Matt's question about the viability of the U.S. occupation there now, you're putting an awful lot of hope in Iraq becoming a kind of autonomous player here, friendly to the United States, but standing on its own feet. Do you see things on that path, or is that in itself now a strategic risk point?
No, I think it is a strategic risk. I think that it's entirely possible for Iraq to follow that path. I certainly hope it does, and I actually think that some of the things the administration has just started to do might turn us around and get us back in the right direction. But in point of fact, in my article, I don't make that assumption. In fact, I assume that Iraq might actually turn out to be a very difficult player in all of this and might once again be a source of problems for us in the future. As I said before, one of the concerns out there is, what if you get an Iraq that once again is threatening to the Saudis and the Kuwaitis? You've got to be in a position to deal with that again. And we ought to be in a position to do it in a better way than we did in the 1990s, when dealing with the Iraqi threat helped to create problems for Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the other Gulf states.
Ken Pollack, stand by. We've got to take another short break. We're talking tonight with Ken Pollack, director of the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, former National Security Council Persian Gulf expert, CIA Persian Gulf analyst. You can join this conversation. Are you ready to see the United States openly commit long-term to a dominant role in the Persian Gulf? Does Washington have a choice? Are Americans honest with themselves about the strategic imperative to defend, to control, at some sense, the free flow of Persian Gulf oil? Or do you accept that control, that domination as... I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the big picture, future of the Persian Gulf, high stakes, high strategy in America, right in the thick of it. Our guest is Ken Pollack. He was with the National Security Council from 1999 to 2001, director of the staff for Persian Gulf Affairs there, a longtime Iran-Iraq military analyst at the CIA, author last year of The Threatening Storm, the case for invading Iraq, and of the article Securing the Gulf in the July-August issue of Foreign Affairs magazine. You can join the conversation tonight. Is a large, long-term U.S. military presence in the Persian Gulf now a necessity? Or is it a kind of quagmire? How do you think the Middle East, the Gulf, would evolve without U.S. oversight, U.S. dominion? Is it right, is it necessary to position Iran as the next big enemy And will U.S. dominance encourage or constrain the progress of Mideast politics toward democracy, toward representative government? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ken Pollack, you've got us into this imperative logic. You've given us the one solution here, which is get back over the horizon. Keep just enough to be militarily effective in the Middle East, but diminish the profile as far as possible. But that comes with problems, you say. Iran might still feel free to push ahead with nuclear weapons development. Iraq might get frisky again. You say there's a couple of other possibilities here, and one you describe as a Middle Eastern NATO. What do you mean by that?
Right. Well, this is kind of the counterpoise to the let's pull out of the Gulf, let's reduce our presence. This would basically say, all right, we've got to reorganize the defenses of the Gulf, and in particular, we've got to formalize our relationship with the Gulf, put that on much solider footing so that the Iranians, the Iraqis, if they once again become problems, will have no doubt that the United States intends to defend them. This is the best way to bolster deterrence. And basically what it says is we're turned over the horizon, pull out of the Gulf, is really most concerned with the internal instability of the Gulf states.
So let me understand this. So, Ken Pollack, this Mideast NATO requires setting Iran up in the role of the Soviet Union as the boogeyman.
Right, exactly.
And then the other states, Iraq, the Gulf states, join a kind of defense coalition with the United States in opposition to Iran. And you see that as producing stability?
Well, I posit this as a possible scenario. In fact, the way I would phrase it differently, you should go this route if you do see Iran as playing the role of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't, if you believe that Persian Gulf, the internal security of the Gulf states is much more important, then you ought to go with the first option we talked about, pulling out of the Gulf, the return to over-the-horizon balancing.
So the upside of this is it gives the United States a kind of construct in which it can have a military presence in the region, but it's all because we're buddy-buddy, we're all on the same team here, we're all in this new Mideastern NATO. What's the downside?
The downside is that you are setting yourself up for problems. You're going to turn Iran into an adversary, and if they aren't now, they will be once you set up this new construct. Second, you might actually be hugging the Persian Gulf states much too closely. This kind of a setup might be just too much for their internal politics to bear.
And blow the lid off domestically for
exactly.
these countries.
They have much preferred these kind of informal relationships that they can kind of plausibly deny with the United States. Setting up a formal alliance with them just might be too much for the traffic to bear.
Because, again, they might look like patsies to the local population.
Exactly.
So there's a final alternative here, then, which you describe, and this is kind of fancy language. You describe it as what Gulf security condominium. But as I understand it, it's basically setting up a huge treaty system over this region where you begin to negotiate security treaties between adversaries, saying, okay, Iran, you do this and we'll guarantee this. We'll, you know, it's along the lines of the endless treaties and negotiations that went on over Europe and Eastern Europe in the 80s and early 90s.
Yeah, that's basically right. I think it's important to remember that those endless treaties that went on in the 80s and 90s produced a much safer Europe. They were painful to negotiate, but this is kind of the approach. As you've not indicated, this is my preferred approach. This is the route I would like to see the United States take, which is trying to develop an arms control approach to the Persian Gulf, basically saying that the way to solve the different security problems of the region is to set up some kind of a security forum where all the states can participate, can talk about what their problems are. You know, one of the biggest problems with the Iranians is they have legitimate security concerns, and they don't think that we care about them. And I think that if we could just give them a forum where they can start talking about their security problems and see that we're taking them seriously, that would be a big problem solver for the Gulf region.
So this is confidence building along the lines of Washington, Moscow, circa mid-1980s.
Exactly. And obviously this is something that we're not going to have a whole lot of time to get into, but there are all kinds of reasons why the different paradoxes that I talked about before, those three different problems that we talked about,
mm-hmm.
that probably the best way to handle all of them is if you could do it through this kind of an arms control format. Thinking long-term, recognizing it's going to be hard,
mm-hmm.
but that the best way to deal with all of these different problems is to get everyone talking confidence-building measures to start reducing the risk of crises, and then over time, arms control treaties to bring down the level of armaments, to bring down the level of concern, to deal with the weapons of mass destruction problems in Iran, in the Gulf, elsewhere, rather than trying to arms race.
Our time is so short, but let's try and slam a couple of calls in here. Mark is calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My question and concern is, how do we rebuild confidence and credibility among our European allies in the face of what is beginning to become transparent, if not frank, subterfuge on the part of our administration in their argument for going into Iraq in the first place? Their claims that there were weapons of mass destruction,
exactly,
et cetera.
Mark, it's a great question. Our time's ticking down. Let me just take it right there because it's such a good one. Ken Pollack, what about it? You were part of the chorus saying we've got a weapons of mass destruction problem here. Now we've got a credibility problem here. How do we get Europe to play ball, to come on board with this? Does the United States need Europe to make any of these long-term security options that you describe pan out?
Sure. Let me get to really the question, because I think the issue of WMD, I don't think that's been resolved yet, and my guess is that we are going to see some stuff come out at some point in time. It won't be quite as scary as the administration painted it, but there will be stuff there. But yes, we need Europe. There's no question about it. The United States is an extremely powerful country, but we are not omnipotent. And there are going to be crises down the road where our ability to handle it is going to be limited, and we're going to need our allies.
So we've got to have them, but we've got a real credibility problem there. Let's get one more call. Courtney's calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Courtney. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you doing, Tom?
Great.
I'd love to throw in a real challenging question right at the end here. But what about the fact that the U.S. is, as well, trying to avoid this issue of losing its currency position, its privileged global currency, sort of reserve currency of the world? What if isn't this imperial military presence needed to sort of prop up the empire here in terms of the dollar, the mighty dollar? And
Courtney, are you not buying Ken Pollack's estimation that the free flow of Persian Gulf oil is absolutely critical? Without it, you get the total world economic collapse.
Well, particularly if the U.S. loses its global currency position, then the price of oil triples immediately. And I think that's one of the big subtext of why we went in there in the first place.
Courtney, our time is so short, I'm going to take it right there. And I don't know if we have time to get into currency issues, but the nub here, Ken Pollack, which I want to put to you as well, is what this boils down to is the United States saying to this region, hey, you can have things any way you like, essentially, as long as this oil flows freely. But that's a big but. And can these countries, in a self-respecting fashion, climb into any of these relationships with the United States that you describe, as long as, underneath the table, there's always the big gun saying it's our way or the highway on this point. Oil must flow.
Well, in all honesty, that's been going on for 50 years, first with us, first with the British, then with us. Mm-hmm. They understand this. And in point of fact, very few Persian Gulf governments have had a problem with it. The two that have, Ayatollah Khomeini's Iran and to a certain extent Saddam's Iraq, were the two problem children of the region. And they were problems not just for us. They were problems for the entire region. They were problems for the greater Middle East. They were problems for the world beyond that.
We've got half a minute left. Is the Bush administration on track toward any of the solutions that you describe? How are they handling it?
I think they're handling it very tactically. I don't think that they're thinking long term yet. That's why I wrote the piece, because I think that we've got an opportunity in Iraq, and if we blow it, we're going to wind up with more operations like this in the future.
And U.S. troops there for a long, long time.
Unfortunately, yes. As I said, I'd love to see us be able to deal with the security of the region in a much less dominant position. I'd like to be able to deal with the problems of the region in a fashion that doesn't force us to go to war there every 6 or 7 years.
Ken Pollack, you've given us what may be a little glimpse of the future tonight. We're grateful for it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Take care.
Ken Pollack is director of the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He was director of Persian Gulf Affairs in the National Security Council from 1999 to 2001 and a longtime Iran-Iraq military analyst at the CIA. You can continue this conversation on our website at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. This is On Point. Two former senior British cabinet ministers testified today that Tony Blair's government skewed intelligence on Iraq's weapons programs to justify a war it had already decided to wage. Former Foreign Secretary Robin Cook was the first witness to appear before the House of Commons Foreign Affairs Committee's inquiry into how intelligence was used in the months before the war on Iraq. Former International Development Secretary Claire Short testified later in the day. Cook, who quit his job as leader of the House of Commons in March to protest the British government's moves toward war, says he would not be surprised if no substantial evidence of chemical or biological weapons is ever found in Iraq. Here are excerpts from Robin Cook's testimony.
Intelligence, one should understand, it comes in an enormous broad range. It's a bit like an alphabet soup. You get all the letters of the alphabet. You can try there by studying it carefully to try and come up with a coherent statement. I fear on this occasion what happened was that those bits of the alphabet that supported the case were selected. Now, that's not deceit, it's not invention, it is not coming up with intelligence that didn't exist, but it was not presenting the whole picture. And I fear the fundamental problem is that instead of using intelligence as evidence in which to base a conclusion about policy, we used intelligence as the basis in which we could justify a policy in which we'd already settled.
Chief.
Thanks, Chairman.
In a previous stage of our reporting on weapons of mass destruction, we were advised by one key witness that 1,000 litres of anthrax or less would be almost impossible to discover in a place like Iraq. The real key to this for me is, if it's impossible to discover 1,000 litres or less of anthrax, which clearly has the potential to incredible damage to many people, would the advice have been that if it was impossible to remove the threat, the chemical or biological weapon, the only sensible policy to pursue would be to remove the organisation that would use that threat?
As you rightly say, these things are difficult to find, easy to conceal, and therefore we were not able to make the progress that we had hoped up until 1998. On the other hand, after 1998, we did not have any reason to believe, or any compelling urgent reason to believe, that containment was not working in the sense of keeping Saddam in his cage. I would also make the point that the biological agents such as anthrax are extremely toxic and a menace to anybody near them. But they were not weaponized, though. And if not weaponized, cannot be used for military purpose. I never actually saw any intelligence suggest that Saddam had successfully weaponized that material. The one other point I would make is that whilst it is certainly true that 10,000 liters is a small volume and not terribly easy to find if you're actually searching for it, we now actually have under interrogation all the senior figures from the Iraqi weapons program. It makes it particularly odd that if these things exist, we've not been led to them. And their existence must be known to scores, if not hundreds, of people who were involved in the transport, storage, protection of such material. It's curious that none of them have come forward, since the reward would be immense. They could have their own ranch in Texas if they were to lead us to such a thing at the present time.
Ms. Stewart, please.
Thank you. Is there a structural problem in the way we use and assess intelligence, or is it just the conclusions we have drawn?
I think the charge is graver than we lacked a proper philosophic method. We went to war. 5,000 to 7,000 civilians were killed. Some British troops were killed. To go to war, you need to have a real compelling justification for breaking that taboo, which war should necessarily represent, and to embark upon wholesale military action. It's not a matter of simply sitting around debating whether Weta Kathesian approached intelligence reports. It's a question of whether you really did have compelling, convincing evidence that Saddam posed, as the Prime Minister expressed it, a current and serious threat. It is plain from all we now know he did not pose a current and serious threat. It is therefore a grievous error of policy to have gone to war on the assumption he was.
Robin Cook, former House of Commons leader Robin Cook, testifying before the Foreign Affairs Committee on Britain's House of Commons today. U.S. Senate hearings on pre-war intelligence will begin this week. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.